Good afternoon. Welcome to today's webinar, a U.S. Supreme Court roundup on civil justice and other economics-related issues from the 2019-2020 term, sponsored by the Law and Economics Center at the George Mason University's Scalia Law School. I'm Donald Koshin, and I'm an incoming professor of law at Scalia Law and the incoming deputy executive director of the Law and Economics Center. I'll be moderating today's discussion. The mission of the Law and Economics Center is to serve as a nexus for academic research and education that focuses on the timely and relevant economic analysis of legal and public policy issues confronting judges, lawyers, and policymakers nationwide. The vision of the Law and Economics Center is that when policymakers understand economics, they're more likely to make sound decisions that support the rule of law and free enterprise, thus advancing innovation, entrepreneurship, job creation, and economic growth. Our commitment at the LEC is to developing original, high-quality law and economics research and educational programs that further enhance economic understanding and impact policy decisions. We thank all of you for joining us today to be part of that ongoing dialogue. Our panel of three experts, each with extensive appellate litigation experience, including before the U.S. Supreme Court, will provide analysis on some of the most important decisions released this past term at the Supreme Court. The panelists will frame many of their remarks to focus on those cases decided by the court that are most relevant for the future of civil justice, those to which economic analysis was most influential, or those from which we should expect the greatest economic impact. So that we can reserve time for substantive discussion among the panelists and with you in the Q&A, I'm not going to give extensive bios. They all have impressive backgrounds and have developed extensive expertise on issues we will discuss, and I recommend that you click their names on the invitation you received from the LEC or by visiting the LEC website at masonlec.org, where you can also find out more information about the LEC. So today's panel features Andrew Pincus, who's a partner at Mayer Brown, Lucas Townsend, who's a partner at Gibson Dunn, and Melissa Arbuscheri, who's a partner at Latham & Watkins LLP. Each panelist will speak for about 10 minutes, then we'll have some intra-panel discussion, followed by audience Q&A. If you have a question, please use the chat function in your platform and send a direct message in chat to host or Aaron Murphy. Either will do. Please identify yourself in the text of your message and keep your questions short so that they can be readily incorporated into this virtual format. Please do not chat directly with the panelists as they will not be monitoring the chat box during today's call, but instead will see your messages through our Q&A period. You may also email if you're on the phone joining us, or otherwise it's easier for you. You may email your questions to ccjca@gmu.edu. Again, that's ccjca@gmu.edu. It's been an interesting term, as always, at the Supreme Court, and I'm excited to learn more, as all of you, I'm sure, are too, from our experts on what the impact is and what we should expect to see the results will be as a from many of these decisions. So with that, I turn it over to Andy Pincus. Andy, take us away.
Thanks very much, and thanks to George Mason and the LEC for asking me to be with you today, and thanks to all of you for tuning in. I'm going to start by talking about two of the court's decisions dealing with separation of powers issues. This is a court that's been very focused on upholding the structural provisions of the Constitution, the separation of powers principles that undergird the division of the federal government into three branches. And the courts emphasized that it's not only upholding them for themselves, but it's emphasized that these structural provisions protect individual liberty. Excuse me, by diffusing power and by making clear who's responsible for governmental decisions so that the electorate may hold them accountable. And that's certainly an important factor with respect to the two decisions that I'll talk about. And just a disclosure, I've been involved as a litigant or representing amici with respect to a number of the cases that I'll talk about today. But let me start with the Seal of Law case, which involved a question about the constitutionality of the structure of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, that agency that was created by Congress after the 2008 financial crisis to sort of centralize a federal consumer protection in financial matters. It was created as an independent agency, and as we know, historically, most independent agencies in the federal government have followed what I'll call the Federal Trade Commission model, multi-member commissions with each commissioner having a fixed term and removable by the president only for cause, but with the caveat that a majority of the commissioners can't be from the same party and that they have staggered terms, that the president can designate the chair of the commission, who typically holds a lot of power, and that those agencies go through the congressional appropriations process to get the money for their operations. The CFPB was unique from the beginning. It was headed by only a single director, removable by the president only for cause. The statute says inefficiency, neglect, or malfeasance. The agency was totally exempted from the congressional appropriations process. It requests a set amount each year. The director, in his or her sole discretion, requests a set amount that I think this year is up to about $600 and some odd million, and can spend it as she sees fit, with no oversight by Congress, no control by Congress, no need for approval by Congress, no need for approval by the president. The director appoints all of the subordinate officers of the agency, and there's no review by the Office of Management Budget of the agency's testimony before Congress, its interactions with Congress, as is true for many other agencies. And the folks who designed the Bureau made pretty clear that their goal was to completely insulate it from the political process and from political pressures. Sort of an interesting goal when you have a representative form of government, which is how our Constitution is based. This case, Sela Law, a law firm that was the target of a civil investigative demand by the agency seeking information about its business. It was a debt collection services law firm. The Sela Law wouldn't comply. The agency moved to enforce its CID, and Sela Law resisted on a number of grounds, including that the agency's structure was unconstitutional, and therefore the director didn't have the power to issue the CID or to litigate the case enforcing it. Of course, the Supreme Court in the Humphreys executor case in the 1930s had upheld the FTC model. Later, more recently, in the Morrison case, the Supreme Court had upheld the independent counsel when we had an independent counsel statute. Both of those officials, the FTC commissioners and the independent counsel, had similar protections against removal. The question really was, is this case really different? Is there a difference between a multi-member commission and a single director? And the Supreme Court majority said yes, a 5-4 decision, with the majority decision on this issue written by the Chief Justice. The court said, first of all, removal power, although it's not expressly set forth in the Constitution, the president's removal power is, of course, critical to the constitutional scheme. The president's obligation to take care of that the law be faithfully executed, he couldn't do that if he didn't have a way to work his will on the subordinate officials who were actually carrying out policy. The court said Humphrey's executor permitted for-cause removal protections because the FTC was a multi-member body of experts. It was balanced along partisan lines. It performed legislative and judicial functions, but not executive power, at least the way the Humphreys executor court described it. We might take issue with that description today. The Morrison case, the court said, involved an inferior officer. The independent counsel had very limited jurisdiction and tenure, didn't have significant policymaking authority, so very different from the director of the CFPB, who has all of those things. The court said it was not going to expand those exceptions to the general rule that the president has plenary removal authority because of significant differences between the multi-member commission and the CFPB. First of all, history. The CFPB structure was unprecedented, and the courts looked a lot to history in this context. Second, the significant governmental power vested in a single individual accountable to no one. The CFPB director is in charge of rulemaking, adjudication, enforcement authority with very large penalties, all big differences, and the exemption from appropriations oversight. So the court said, we're not going to uphold the structure. This is unconstitutional. Justices Thomas and Gorsuch would have gone farther. They would have overruled Humphrey's executor and said, even with respect to multi-member commissioners, the president has to have plenary removal authority, but that did not carry the day. Then the question was for the court, okay, the structure is unconstitutional. What do we do about it? Is the remedy here to simply strike the restrictions on the president's removal authority and leave the rest of the agency intact? Is it to say those removal authority restrictions are not severable from the rest of the statute, and therefore the entire Title 10 of the Dodd-Frank Act that created the CFPB has to be struck down? Or should the court just not address this severability question and just say the issue here is enforcement of the CID, the Bureau is unconstitutional, that the CID can't be enforced? A majority, all of the four dissenters and justices, Chief Justice Roberts and Justices Alito and Kavanaugh said, we're going to go with the narrow remedy. We're just going to pencil out, in a way, the removal restrictions and leave the rest of the law intact. Justices Thomas and Gorsuch, again, would have said, the court's job is not to rewrite statutes. We think the answer here is just to deny enforcement and leave the questions about whether this what's intact and what's not for another day when a case arises resulting raising that question. The other interesting question, which the court left for remand, is what happens to all the decisions that CFPB directors made while the Bureau was unconstitutionally structured? Are they invalid? Can they be ratified? Is a do-over of everything required? Lots of rules, lots of enforcement actions in the decade since the CFPB was formed. Well, the CFPB answered that question with respect to regulations pretty quickly, because the week after the Supreme Court's decision, the director issued a ratification of just about all of the rules that the CFPB had issued, with two exceptions. That ratification said, ratifying all the rules, we're not going to have a blanket ratification of enforcement actions. We'll look at those on an individual basis and decide what to do later. Are those ratifications lawful? Do they solve the problem? Courts in prior cases involving decisions that invalidating either the appointment or the tenure of presidentially appointed officials have been pretty generous in upholding ratifications, both certainly in the enforcement context and with respect to district courts, at least in the regulatory context. So we'll have to see what happens with these decisions. The other case I'll touch on just for a minute, because I do want to say a word about standing, is the Aurelius case. The same question in a different context. The commission created by Congress to oversee Puerto Rico's bankruptcy, to file bankruptcy petitions on behalf of Puerto Rico and help with its restructuring. There, the president had the power to appoint the board's seven members without Senate confirmation. How did the appointments clause deal with that question? Were they exempt because they just had to do with Puerto Rico? The court unanimously said that those appointments are constitutional. The majority said, we're not going to have a blanket exception for local boards created with the Congress's territorial authority from the appointments clause, but we are going to say that the appointments clause doesn't apply when officials have purely local duties as these do. So there, the court taking sort of a practical view of the appointments clause. I want to turn quickly to an ERISA case, the Thole case, not to talk so much about ERISA, which is a statute with incredible complexities, but to talk about the standing issue that the court decided there. A couple of years ago, in 2015, the court decided a case called Spokio against Robbins, full disclosure, I argued it, which raised the question of what is required for Article III standing. If a statute provides a cause of action and statutory damages, if the plaintiff alleges the elements of the cause of action, but doesn't allege that he or she suffered actual injury, does that let the plaintiff get into federal court? And the Supreme Court said no. The fact that the statute creates a cause of action and provides for damages does not establish standing. A plaintiff still needs concrete injury. The case was remanded. Lower courts dismissed a lot of cases, but some courts read it narrowly. Cert petitions were denied. And some people felt that perhaps the Supreme Court was walking away for that decision. In a case last year called Frank v. Gauss, Justice Thomas dissented and said that he would have found standing where the majority remanded the issue. But in Thole, the court gave a pretty full-throated reaffirmation of Spokio, saying in this case involving a claim by beneficiaries of a defined benefit plan, a plan where you get a set monthly amount, who hadn't been denied any of their payments, the court said, you haven't lost anything. You claim your plan was mismanaged, but you haven't suffered concrete harm, and therefore you can't sue. So I think a bit of a reaffirmation of Spokio, which I think will lead to a lot more standing claims being raised, challenges being raised in the lower courts. Thanks very much, and I'll wrap up there and look forward to questions.
Thank you very much, Andy. Please remember that if you'd like to ask a question, you can go into the chat function and chat to host or Aaron Murphy, either one. Chat your question in the chat box here on WebEx, or you can email ccjca@gmu.edu, ccjca@gmu.edu. Please feel free to enter those questions as the speakers are speaking. We will get to them toward the end. With that, I turn it over to Lucas Townsend from Gibson Dunn.
Thank you, and thank you to George Mason University and to our audience members today. This term was a banner year for intellectual property cases at the Supreme Court. There were seven IP cases, and I'll focus on one of those cases, Georgia v. Public Resource Org, Inc., a copyright case that I think provides an interesting case study. The case involved a question of whether the annotations in the Official Code of Georgia Annotated, or OCGA, can be copyrighted. The OCGA is Georgia's official law code. It consists of the text of every Georgia statute and non-binding annotations summarizing various interpretations of the statutes. Matthew Bender and company creates the annotations under contract with the Code Revision Commission, which is a legislative body within the Georgia legislature. Each year, the commission sends its annotations to the legislature to be approved and published in the OCGA. So this case arose after Public Resource Org, a nonprofit organization, published the annotated OCGA online. And on behalf of the Georgia legislature, the Code Revision Commission sued Public Resource Org for copyright infringement. Their theory was that the OCGA the annotations were protected by copyright held by the Georgia legislature. Public Resource Org counterclaimed on the ground that the entire OCGA, including the annotations, was in the public domain. So the question was, are the code annotations original works of authorship under the Copyright Act 17 USC Section 102A? In a 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court held that the code annotations are not original works of authorship that can be copyrighted. And the court divided in a most unusual way. Chief Justice Roberts wrote for the majority that consisted of Justices Sotomayor, Kagan, Gorsuch, and Kavanaugh. Justice Thomas wrote a dissent that was joined by Justice Alito and in substantial part by Justice Breyer. And Justice Ginsburg wrote a dissent that was joined by Justice Breyer. The court announced a rule that it called the government edicts doctrine, that officials empowered to speak with the force of law cannot be the authors of and therefore cannot copyright the works they create in the course of their official duties. And the court claimed that this limitation is found in the word authorship in the Copyright Act, 17 USC 102A. Now, I'll just pause here and I'll submit that there's really nothing in the ordinary meaning of the word author or authorship that implies this limitation. I think it's common even among lawyers to refer to judges as being the authors of their opinions or legislators as being the authors of legislative reports or even laws. Notably, the court did not begin with the text of the statute as it so often does in statutory cases. It said, we begin with precedent. And the court went back to a trio of 19th century cases, Wheaton v. Peters from 1834, Banks v. Manchester, and Callahan v. Myers, both from 1888. Each of those cases dealt with claims of copyright held by official court reporters. According to Chief Justice Roberts, this trio of cases established a straightforward rule that because judges are vested with the authority to make and interpret the law, they cannot be the author of the works they prepare in the discharge of their judicial duties. It's interesting, I'll just note as an aside, it's interesting that the court has never before referred to the government edicts doctrine in any decision. And the key case, the key precedent on which the court relied, Banks v. Manchester, had been cited by the court only a handful of times and never for the proposition that judges and legislators acting in their official capacity cannot be authors under the Copyright Act. But the court said that the animating principle here is that no one can own the law. And interestingly, the court rejected an argument that would have limited the government edicts doctrine to pronouncements that carry the force of law. The court analogized to a judge's dissenting opinion, which does not carry the force of law, but is nevertheless not copyrightable. The court said what matters is who is the author? Is it an official responsible for creating the law? And were they acting in the discharge of their lawmaking function? The court then extended the doctrine to legislators. The court said if judges acting as judges cannot be authors because of their authority to make and interpret the law, it follows that legislators cannot be either. And here again, the court rejected an argument that this rule should be limited to the text of the laws themselves, but instead the court extended the rule to explanatory and procedural materials that legislators create in the discharge of their legislative duties. And so applying this rule, the court concluded that the OCGA annotations created under the supervision of the Code Revision Commission could not be copyrighted. The court first concluded that the commission was the sole author of the annotations under the work for hire agreement with Matthew Bender and its parent Lexis. And the court also concluded that the commission was an arm of the Georgia legislature under Georgia law. The court looked to how the commission was created, its membership, its funding, and the fact that its proposed annotations are approved by the Georgia legislature and being merged with the statutory text. Lastly, the court concluded that the commission's creation of the annotations was done in the course of the legislature's official duties. And so therefore, the test was satisfied. The commission's annotations were created by legislators in the course of their legislative duties and could not be copyrighted under the government edicts doctrine. So if you're wondering how all of this springs out of the word authorship, the court acknowledged that the rule originated as a statement of public policy in 19th century cases, and that it does not necessarily reflect kind of modern modes of statutory interpretation. But the court said that Congress knew that this was the Supreme Court's interpretation, and Congress has adopted that interpretation in periodically reenacting the authorship requirement. So the word authorship now carries that settled meaning. I think you probably cannot fully explain, though, the court's opinion as an instance in which the court felt that its hands were tied by precedent, because the court went on to give a rather full-throated defense of the public policy rationale behind the government edicts doctrine. And it's interesting that no justice in the majority declined to join that portion of the opinion. The court said, imagine that a Georgia citizen wants to learn his legal rights and duties. If he reads the what the court called economy class version of the code without the annotations, he'll find an assortment of laws, some of which have been held to be unconstitutional and unenforceable, and yet have not been cleared from the statute books. And meanwhile, first-class readers with access to the annotations will learn the true state of the laws interpreted by the courts. The Supreme Court also worried about states monetizing their legislative history and creating premium legal services that citizens and attorneys cannot copy without threat of infringement liability and possible criminal sanctions. And the court worried that the fair use doctrine is not a robust enough doctrine to protect against such uses. I think the decision is instructive, not so much for its absolute holding as for showing the justices' different approaches to precedent, to statutory construction, and to the use of public policy. The majority really, I think, embraced here a public policy rationale and declined to analyze the text under the Copyright Act. The majority opinion kind of broadly proclaims that no one can own the law. It expressed concerns over the fairness of this of first class and economy class versions of the code. But I think also having embraced policy, it's notable that the court did not use the opportunity to discuss the economic policy underlying the Copyright Act and copyright protections. Publishers contract with states to create official annotations in exchange for copyright exclusivity. The majority kind of acknowledged an argument that the state of Georgia was making in this regard, but the court's answer was it's up to Congress to fix any bad outcomes that come from this holding. I think only Justice Thomas's dissent really kind of grappled with the economics of the arrangements, and he noted that under its contract, Lexis was required to publish the OCGA at a steeply discounted price of $404 compared to the competing West Publishing annotation, which cost $2,570. And in return, Lexis received the exclusive right to publish the OCGA annotations. But without copyright protection, that exclusivity is now gone. And Justice Thomas worried that without these economic incentives, state annotated codes could disappear and force even more people into the economy class version of the code. So in sum, I think in this case, it's an interesting case study, very interesting alignment of votes. I think the court may have missed an opportunity to ground its policy rationale in the economic principles that underlie IP protections, in this case, copyright protections. And with that, I'll turn it back to Professor Koshin.
Thank you very much, Lucas. Before we turn to our final panelist, I want to remind you that you can use the chat box to enter questions. Please direct those questions to either host or to Aaron Murphy. You may also send your questions to ccjca@gmu.edu. That's ccjca@gmu.edu, and those will get directed to me to present to our panelists in just a few minutes. But before we get to the Q&A, we have our final panelist, Melissa Arbuscheri from Latham & Watkins, LLP. Melissa, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Thank you so much, and thanks for having me, and thanks the attendees who have decided to join us today. I'm going to talk about two cases. These are both front page cases that came out of this term, but not really because of the economic implications. I think those are a little bit more hidden, but maybe also quite important and worth focusing on. So the first case is the DACA case that was decided, the Deferred Action for a Child at Arrivals case. This was a 5-4 decision. It was written by the chief, which after our individual presentations is something you've heard, I guess, a little bit already this afternoon. It ultimately vacated the administration's rescission of DACA, and it did so under the Administrative Procedure Act. So let me start with a few words on the decision, and then I can kind of do more to explain why I'm decided to talk about it today during this particular panel. So as many of you may know, during the Obama administration back in 2012, the Department of Homeland Security announced this DACA program, which essentially allowed certain immigrants who entered the U.S. as children to apply for forbearance of removal and also to get some associated benefits, including work authorization, among other things. Fast forward 5 years, there's a change of administrations. It's now 2017, and the Department of Homeland Security decides to rescind that policy. Now, the fight before the court centered not on whether DHS could rescind the policy. Everyone agreed that it was perfectly permissible for the department to do that, but the fight really was about how DHS went about rescinding the policy. Really specifically, the question was whether the department had adequately explained its reason for doing so. The five justices in the majority thought there was only one place that you could look to for that explanation, and that was the decision that was offered at the time of the rescission, which was this so-called Duke memoranda. So looking at that, there was one reason given for rescission, and it was that DACA, as initially adopted, was illegal. And what the court said is, basically, the majority didn't weigh in on that question. It didn't decide whether or not DACA was illegal. It, for lack of a better word, punted on that issue and instead said, regardless of whether it was legal or illegal at the time, the rescission was still unlawful under the APA because the department failed to consider two important things. The first being distinguishing between the forbearance of removal on the one hand and the benefits that were afforded on the other. What the majority said was that the previous decisions that spoke to illegality focused only on benefits and not on forbearance, and yet the department failed to consider when it rescinded the entire policy whether there's a possible distinction between the two on that issue. But secondly, the court also said that the department failed to consider reliance interest, and that's where the economic implications start coming into play. One important argument that was made in the case, and that actually made it into the chief's opinion, was really economic in nature. There were employers that submitted amicus briefs, there were governments that submitted amicus briefs saying that DACA recipients were really important parts of their workforces. They were an important part of the GDP and an important part of the state, local, and federal government's tax base. This argument was made by the plaintiffs as well, but also in several amicus briefs, one of which was submitted on behalf of 143 different businesses and written by my fellow panelists, who I would normally say is sitting next to me, but at least is on the screen near me, maybe, Andy Pincus. And so a few points from those briefs. Number one, the argument was the DACA recipients create jobs. They contribute to the public fisc. They stimulate the economy. And that over the next decade, there were numbers associated with this. Over the next decade, it would cost the national GDP over $460 billion if DACA was to go away. It would reduce tax revenues by about $90 billion. And then also that a number of DACA recipients, I think it was about 9%, have started their own businesses, which itself both generates jobs, generates sales, generates taxes, and the like. And so the majority focused on that. It found these economic implications noteworthy enough not only to mention in the decision, but actually also to warrant a remand back to the agency for the agency to consider those among admittedly many other reliance arguments and hardship arguments that were being made in the case. Now, taking a step back, does that mean that the DACA decision itself is going to have economic implications? It sort of depends. As I kind of started, it really was a fairly limited decision. Again, no question that DHS can rescind DACA. No one was disputing that, so it could do the same thing again. Also, this illegality question wasn't answered by the majority, and so it's still somewhat lingering in the background. And then also, even with respect to reliance, the majority recognized these reliance interests, said the department was required to consider them, but then also said the department maybe could rightly think that they were not terribly significant, could discount them, could say they were outweighed by other interests and the like. And perhaps most significantly, there's a lot of uncertainty that remains at this point. And uncertainty is rarely helpful when trying to figure out predictable economic outcomes and returns. And so immediately after this decision, the administration said it was going to rescind DACA again. It hasn't yet done so. Immediately after the decision, DHS refused to accept new DACA applications, although very recently a district court judge ordered them to do so. And so ultimately, because this really is an executive policy decision, at least at this point, it may just depend on the administration, and ultimately it may just depend on Congress. That, after all, was the focus. Justice Kavanaugh wrote a dissent that pretty much says this decision really doesn't do anything to eliminate the broader uncertainty over the status of DACA recipients, and I think that has to be true. And so while the economic impacts of DACA may have helped the court and may have moved the court in some ways, the real important question is whether they are going to sway or may also sway the administration and Congress, either now or in the future. So that's the first case. The second one, which maybe is even a step further removed, I was going to talk about, is the Title VII decision. And this is Bostock versus Clayton County. It was a 6-3 decision. This one was written by Justice Gorsuch, although joined by the chief. And the court there held that an employer who fires an employee based on sexual orientation or transgender status has discriminated based on sex under Title VII. And so we were just talking a little bit about textualism and how the case that Lucas was talking about wasn't so much textual in nature. This is on the flip side of that. It was a very strictly textual decision. The decision in the majority basically was in changing the employee's sex would have yielded a different outcome, then there's a statutory violation, and that it's impossible to discriminate against a person for being gay or being transgender without discriminating against that individual based on sex. More details about that, but that's essentially the nature of the majority of decision. And the real fight in this case between the majority and the dissenting opinions was about who had the correct textual approach. And so the majority took a more literalist approach and didn't so much care what Congress may have been thinking when it adopted Title VII. And the dissent looked at it more in terms of ordinary meaning and the like. And if you look through all of the opinions, the name that comes up throughout is Justice Scalia's name. It's invoked in, I think, every opinion that came out in the case. And the real debate among the justices was pretty much what would Justice Scalia have done? And they just had different answers on that question. And so nothing in the decision talks about economics, talks about businesses, or anything along those lines. But if you take a step back and look at the briefing in that case, you'll start to see something somewhat similar to what you saw in DACA, in that there were briefs submitted by a number of businesses speaking to the economic implications of that decision. Differences in this case, the businesses were on both sides of the issue. And so there was one really notable amicus brief that was submitted on behalf of the side of the employees. It was 206 businesses signed on to that. And it's similar to the DACA amicus brief, it explained that LGBT employees contributed to the workforce. It explained they also contribute to the economy in a lot of, in mass numbers. I think it said buying power of this community in 2015 was something in the $900 billion range, and talked about how costly it is to have to replace workers who leave because of discrimination. Another amicus brief, and sort of in Andy's nature, full disclosure, it's one that I helped draft, but spoke about the cascading effects of workplace discrimination on unemployment and how that leads to increased government benefits, reduced economic output, and the like. And the other thing that the brief that was submitted on behalf of the 200-plus businesses talked about is how LGBT employees who are out in their workplace are more productive, and how non-discrimination protections help companies in a variety of ways in terms of recruiting top talent, increasing productivity, and the like. But that was just one side. So on the other side, a number of businesses filed a brief in support of the employer, highlighting the impact that this would have on small businesses in particular, and also really focusing on the complexity of the compliance in this particular context. And so that latter argument in terms of like, okay, so if Title VII covers these individuals, then what does that mean? And what does that mean for the day-to-day on the employer side of things? Because unlike race, the prohibition on discrimination based on sex isn't absolute. There are things like the bona fide occupational qualification exception, the BFOQ exception, as wordy as that may seem. There's an exception. And so the question is, how does it apply in this particular context? And the court didn't answer that question, and it didn't really have to, because the facts before the court were easy and kind of streamlined by the time it got to the court. So the question there in all three cases was the individual had been fired. So there was no debate as to whether it was a qualifying adverse employment action. There was no argument before the court about potential religious exceptions at that point. There's no argument about this BFOQ exception. And so the majority didn't have to and didn't decide any of those issues. It really left them for another day. And so what do we know? We now know that Title VII covers sexual orientation. It covers transgender status. As far as what that means for employers, we're just going to have to wait for the next case.
Excellent. Thank you very much to all the panelists. We're going to take a few minutes just to offer the panelists an opportunity to respond and react to anything they heard from their fellow panelists. And so I'll start there. Lucas, did you have any additional thoughts?
The last point that Melissa had made, we will see how some of the questions that the court left open in the Title VII cases will play out in future cases. I believe that something like 30 states and the District of Columbia already had employment laws in place that covered LGBT employees. And so it's interesting to kind of wonder how, whether there will be actually a big impact in the majority of jurisdictions.
I'd just draw one connection between the DACA case that Melissa talked about and the CELA law case that I talked about. You know, they both, I think, reflect this court's concern about administrative agencies, federal agencies, and I think belief that the rules applicable to those agencies need to be applied in a, I wouldn't say tough, but maybe tough is the right answer. At least when a recognition that these agencies exercise broad power in CELA law, recognition of the very broad powers of the CFPB over a big chunk of the economy. In the DACA case, a recognition that the revocation, the about face of a federal policy creates ripples throughout the economy and has real impacts on people who may have relied on the prior rule, and that the agency has to take account of those at least before it makes its decision. So I think both those cases continue a trend that we've seen in the last several years of a recognition of the sort of awesome power of federal regulatory agencies and a feeling that those agencies need to abide by the rules that govern their operations when they're exercising that power with respect to the with implications on the private sector.
I think that's exactly right. I think another similarity maybe between those cases and other ones that were decided this term is somewhat the narrowness of the decision and the number of questions that are still open for another day. And, you know, to be clear, I don't think the Title VII decision, you know, really was a narrow decision. It decided a very important issue that that was before the court. But if you think about how the court decided the DACA case, I mean, again, Justice Kavanaugh's dissent kind of highlights it. It is a somewhat technical decision, just sending it back to work those square corners, I think is the language that the court focused on in the majority. And then in CELA law too, you said there's a lot of questions left to figure out in terms of ratification and the like. And so in some ways, I think in these cases, the impact of the actual decision in the particular context may depend on what happens on remand, and the court is kind of taking it piece by piece as the cases come, or maybe that's, you know, what's a helpful way to get to a majority is just to focus on sort of the most narrow and careful way to decide the questions before the court and to let the other issues linger and be subject to percolation in the lower courts before it maybe someday comes back to the court.
Each of you focused on cases that teed up potential responses from the legislative branch. A number of people on our call today are indeed policymakers at state or federal in federal legislatures. Do you have any predictions on how the legislative branches might react to some of these decisions? Some of you have touched on this already, but any predictions on how the court has sort of kicked the ball back into Congress's court if they want to change the outcome in any of these cases that you've discussed?
Go
ahead, Lucas.
I was going to start off with what I think is the easy one in the Georgia case. I suspect there's probably not going to be a groundswell of support for Congress to amend the Copyright Act to allow judges and legislators to hold a copyright in their official actions and their official writings. With respect to kind of the ancillary question, which was decided in the Georgia cases about kind of supporting annotations and other things, I think there might be some legislative tweaks there. One of the pieces of litigation going on now in response to that decision is the role of model codes. Private organizations create model codes for the purpose of persuading legislatures to adopt those model codes. It's a big part of the economy. There's a lot of economic incentive in doing that. And it's playing out in litigation right now. I think if you see a wave of court decisions that say, no, these are barred by the government edicts doctrine, there could be a legislative response. You may see some tweaks from Congress. I'm sorry, Andy, go ahead.
I was just going to say, with respect to the CFPB, there's been a continuing debate about whether the single director model makes sense even before the court's decision, or whether switching to the more traditional multi-member commission sort of would put the CFPB on the same footing as the SEC and the FTC and the other agencies that we have in that category. I think that debate will continue, but you know, it's hard for Congress to do a lot these days. So I'm not sure that that change is something that that is coming down the pike anytime soon.
That's actually what I was going to say, the last part. I mean, in some ways, these cases arose out of congressional inaction and the sort of attempts to pass legislation and the failures for that to happen is somewhat what led to DACA and the decision in the case. And also on the Title VII side, I mean, in both instances, there were with legislation that could be pointed to that was proposed to either deal with immigration reform on the one hand or to, some would say, expand Title VII, some might say redefine Title VII to include sexual orientation and or transgender status, and none of that legislation, you know, even though it's proposed multiple times, kind of ever got through. Now, some thought the failure to pass legislation was actually relevant to the legal analysis that might bear on what the statute means in the Title VII context, or what the court should do in the DACA context. But it seems like probably the biggest, I think there will be continuing debate. I'm not as sure if there'll be continuing debate in the Title VII context. I feel like maybe there'll be less focus on that. There will undoubtedly be, I think, continuing debate in the immigration context, but whether that will actually lead to a resolution of anything, I find myself a little bit skeptical or pessimistic at this point that we'll see much traction.
I think we'll turn to some audience questions. We have several in the queue now, and if you would like to enter the queue, please type your question in the chat box to either host or to Aaron Murphy. You can also email your questions to ccjca@gmu.edu. That's ccjca@gmu.edu. Andy, this question comes to you, and it kind of builds off of your final comment just a few moments ago. Gordon Vincent asks, the court often gives hints or roadmaps showing how to do it the right way the next time. Was there anything in the CFPB opinion, a roadmap showing how to create an unaccountable self-funded agency in the future, or is it CFPB really going to be one of a kind? Is the idea dead?
I think the court's opinion makes it very difficult to replicate the CFPB model. Certainly one of the things that the court emphasized was the broad power that the director has, that the agency has, both in terms of the scope of its regulatory reach. CFPB is not an agency that just regulates certain types of businesses. It regulates about 10 kinds of activities that are financial in nature, no matter what kind of business does them, and then has various exemptions. But it has broad reach throughout the economy. And also it has rulemaking, adjudication and enforcement authority all together in the person of the director. So it might be that if there was an agency created that didn't have those characteristics, that it might have a better chance of surviving. But I think this is a court that seemed to indicate in this opinion that Humphrey's executor and the FTC structure is about as far as it can go. We may see something about that next term. The court has granted a case about the Federal Housing Finance Agency structure, which similarly has a single director for a term with limits on presidential removal authority. So that may give us a clue about the breadth of the CFPB decision.
Anyone else have any comments on that? All right, let me, Lucas, Thomas Pyle has a question for you. What about the copyright of collections of opinions, including court opinions or collections even of statutes, I suppose, inside of a textbook? So when there's added value by the collection, do all these government works and get protection or no protection when they're compiled by an independent author? In other words, I guess I could paraphrase the question is, are textbooks now phone books?
I think that that probably is the Supreme Court decision probably didn't go that far, because very key to their decision was that the work was that Matthew Bender was creating was overseen by an arm of the Georgia legislature. And so unless you have textbooks that are sort of created with official sanction from state governmental bodies, I would imagine that there's not a lot in this court's decision, in the Georgia decision, that would kind of threaten the copyright, the copyrightability of those types of textbooks. I will say, though, you know, it's interesting, though, to see that the court has that there are examples, and maybe there are more in the future, where the court will kind of declare certain subject matter not copyrightable just because it's, you know, they will deem it not to be subject to the authorship requirement of the Copyright Act. So there could be additional examples in theory in the future down the road.
As a follow-up to that, my own question would be, are there ways in which the contracts you think could be structured such that the oversight is not there on the annotation side, but instead there's just sort of a grant given for the creation of an annotated version in which there's more private control?
I would think yes. Now, the court didn't really analyze the terms of this of the contract, and so just thinking out loud here, the if you had a contract that had a true independent contractor relationship and less control provided for, I suppose you could see an argument for why it doesn't trigger the types of oversight that the Supreme Court was talking about in the Georgia case. I have to say, Kander, I've not seen the contract in this particular case. Maybe that same language was there and would make the argument quite difficult. But it's remarkable that the Supreme Court really did not focus so much on the terms of the contract. It focused on the fact that there was oversight and really the qualities of the agency that was doing the oversight. I think it's an area where you may see litigation in the future about just how important the terms of the contract are in this analysis.
Remember, please, if you want to submit a question, you can submit it to in the chat box to the host or to Aaron Murphy, and you can also submit it to ccjca@gmu.edu. Melissa, the next question comes from William Cassell, who asks, for those states that do not have LGBTQ plus protection statutes, what is the reach and effect of the Title VII case?
Yeah, so it basically means that those states now do have LGBTQ plus protection statutes, but through federal law, through Title VII. And so I think someone had mentioned earlier about half the states, you know, did before this, about half the states didn't. The numbers are a little bit off from that, but roughly speaking. And so this just basically expands it so that there is a nationwide law providing such protections. Now, there may have been some differences between what Title VII covers and protects in terms of what employers it covers size-wise and otherwise than what the state law protects. So I don't think they're completely overlapping in that respect, but it does essentially adopt for those employers that otherwise would be covered by Title VII protections that didn't otherwise or previously exist in the state.
Next question is from David Serto, Judge David Serto. He asks, is there a justice who is now the intellectual leader on issues of economic liberty? Is there anyone emerging as showing a different disposition toward economic liberty than we've seen in the past?
We're all silent. I might mean the answer is no, but.
I think you see a variety of justices speaking out on that issue in different cases. I mean, I don't know that I would nothing necessarily leaps to mind this term, but if you think about last term's decision in the Nick property case about whether property takings claims can be brought under Section 1983 in federal court without exhausting state remedies, I think the Chief Justice's opinion was very focused on the fact that the court's prior Williamson County decision that was overruled by Nick put economic rights and property rights in a second class status in terms of the other constitutionally protected rights. And so in terms of recent opinions, I point to that as certainly one that hits those themes pretty hard.
I think Justice Gorsuch is certainly a contender for the thought leader on issues of economic liberty. Yeah, I mean, I think largely because he really is kind of, he holds up the libertarian end of the Supreme Court, and I think is very forceful speaker on these issues. And we've seen a few cases this term where he has been the decisive vote and has shown the ability to build a consensus that you might not have expected at the outset. So one that comes to mind as a contender for that mantle.
The next question comes from Hira Shah, and she points out, Melissa, this is largely for you, I think. She points out that Justice Gorsuch's argument was based, she says, on sexuality being held constant, and that the change in sex gender may be a distinguishing factor. Is someone who is a bisexual American protected by the textualist ruling in Bostock?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting question. I actually haven't read much commentary on that. I think the question is coming from the right place because of the way the decision is written. At the same time, I just sort of find it hard to believe that courts are going to make that distinction at this point, despite the textual reasoning. One of the sort of debates that came up both at the argument and I think between the majority and the dissenting opinion, because of sort of this textual grounding, is, so, you know, you're saying it's necessarily based on sex, so what about the hypothetical where you actually don't know the sex of the applicant, and so you give, you know, there's an application that has you, you know, you don't put your name on it, you don't check off any box under the sex heading, but you check off your sexual orientation or something like that. So in those circumstances, how can you say it's based on sex when the person who's making the decision has no knowledge? And so the majority kind of dealt with that in a way that the dissent found less than convincing, but I sort of suspect for a similar reason, there will be some way to get to the spot where Title VII is protective of bisexual individuals the same way it's protective of gay and transgender individuals, which is what the court focused on. But I see the concern, but I sort of suspect they'll find a way to get there.
So we've reached the end of the queue of questions with 3 minutes left, and I'd like to turn to closing argument time. And so feel free to use this in any way you wish, but in addition to the homework that our audience has to read all the cases that you've mentioned today, feel free to give them another homework assignment. What case did you not get a chance to talk about today that you think everyone should take a close look at? So 60 seconds or less for each of our panelists to close us out. And we will start, let's go in reverse from the before and start with Melissa.
All right, I'm gonna cheat. I'm not gonna say a case. I'm gonna say, look at the stats from the term. I just thought it was a fascinating term as far as both where the justices end up, what the splits were in the cases, how many decisions the Chief Justice was in the majority for, hint, all but two. I just think if you look at the stats for the term, it really provides a pretty good overview of where the court was, and it's a pretty nuanced answer. So that's my advice.
And where can people find a good statistical breakdown?
Oh, go to SCOTUS blog. They have an awesome stat pack that is on there, so plug for that.
Lucas.
I'm going to cheat a little bit because this is a case we did talk about, but I find the Sela Law case to be just fascinating on a number of levels. And the severability issue in that case is one that's going to figure very big in the upcoming term with the ACCA litigation. And it's a fascinating result in Sela Law because recall that the CFPB was created, when it was created, it received transferred powers from a whole host of independent agencies, And the result of all of this litigation is now all of those powers that were once with independent agencies are now with an accountable agency, accountable to the president. It's very interesting that the court applied severability there. I wonder what it will suggest for the upcoming term in the ACCA litigation. I think we'll see more. We certainly will see more of that in the next year.
Andy?
I guess in terms of opinions not to miss, we didn't talk about the cases that the court decided, the so-called faithless elector cases. What power do states have to bind their presidential electors, and how can they penalize them if the presidential electors, if the state requires it, don't vote in accordance with the popular vote in their state? And it's just a very interesting history lesson, both of the way electors got put into the Constitution and how the court has treated them. The other history lesson that's interesting are the court's two decisions in the cases involving President Trump's tax returns, one involving a subpoena by the Manhattan District Attorney and one congressional subpoena. Again, just really interesting discussions of history and of the Constitution and of the court's decisions, the Chief Justice going back to Chief Justice Marshall in terms of talking about that, those legal issues. So I point people to those.
Thank you. Many thanks to our panelists for joining us here at the Law and Economics Center at George Mason University's Scalia Law School. And thank you to all of you in the audience for being part of this. If you want to know more about the LEC, please visit masonlec.org. And also, please, when you go there, take a look at our upcoming Supreme Court tree view, where we'll pivot and start thinking about the next term upcoming. If we can, it will be live on the Hill on September 25th. If not, we'll see you again probably in one of these virtual formats. And until then, stay safe and healthy. Thank you, everyone. Have a great day.